Hello, and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is Joel.
Hi, my name is Joel, and this is the High and Low podcast. I'm the host, and with me is Spencer.
This isn't the Flop House. We're not going to do this dumb bit.
Wait, what? Come on.
That's how it works.
That's how it works.
Anyway, so this is a special episode to celebrate the icon in Japanese film, Kinuyo Tanaka. She was the second Japanese woman to ever direct a feature film. She's the first Japanese woman to actually have a career directing film. And she also was an iconic actress up there with, like, Setsuko Hara and Toshiro... He's not an actress. Anyway, but yeah, she was managed to have a major career as a director and actress for a long time, and yeah, I think it's about time we finally do an episode on her, because she's kind of really important.
I mean, I don't see why we should have to do an episode on her. We've covered, like, her, like, 7 times or something like that. How many times?
There was, I graduated, but the Ozu movie, which I think one of her first ones, she was in Army, the propaganda movie, the Kiyoshida one we did. She was in...
Wedding Ring?
Wedding Ring. She co-starred with Toshiro in that. She's in Sendaka number 8. She shows up at the end of Redbeard for one scene.
Utamaro and His 5 Women episode. I wasn't on, but I did see that movie.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Yeah, she is one of the leads in that. And...
Now yeah. This one.
And this one, yeah. So she just pops up everywhere. And I just love seeing her on screen. She really... this is a pleasant on-screen presence, even when she's in, like, a Mizoguchi tragedy.
Oh, yeah, she's a good actress, so she can... I mean, this movie alone shows how well she could hold on an entire film behind just her presence and her ability and, like, the way she looks and her mannerisms. It's pretty great.
Yeah, and the movie that we are going to focus on is The Life of Oharu from 1952. And, but first, a little background on Tanaka. She was born 1909, and February 29th, 1909, she died March 21st, 1977, and let's see, I don't want to get too bogged down here, but she started, I did mention one of her first movies, if not her first movie, was... I Graduated But from 1929, an Ozu silent comedy. And around that time, Ozu was living with, I think it's Ozu was still at the time, living with 2 other major directors, Go Sho and Shimizu. And they lived in a house together, and Tanaka was briefly married to Shimizu, and they got divorced 3 or 4 years after getting married. But I think that's where she first met Ozu, and she and Ozu remained friends for a very long time. And she first worked with Mizoguchi in, I believe, 1931. And she has kept showing up in his stuff over and over again, and Mizoguchi liked working with her, she liked working with him. And I think it was 1948 or 49, she got to go on a tour, to, like, America to, I didn't look too much into, like, what the exact thing is, but I was just, like, kind of looking at American movies stuff, like, type thing. Anyway, so, like, she was big enough star to, like, represent Japan, like, what was saying, like, American studios in Hollywood. Like, she's that big of a deal at the time. And, what?
I was going to say that I wonder if that has any relation to the fact that the Life of Oharu is in the public domain here in the U.S. Like, maybe it was pushed through to be released in the U.S. in some way where they didn't renew the copyright or whatever you have. You know, that's complicated in a way that I don't understand how a movie stays out of the public domain so that people can continue to get paid for it.
I don't know. It's like, she has a big enough name that, like, outside of Japan, people knew who she was. And, like, I think Mizoguchi did, I'm pretty sure Mizoguchi was exported out of Japan because Shochiku, the studio he worked for most of his career, they thought his movies could translate across outside of Japan, where with Ozu, I mentioned Ozu episode, his movies in his lifetime never left Japan. And I recently learned after reading the Ozu book that it's because Shochiku did not think his movies would translate outside of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And Ozu seemingly never, he either never fought it or he did, but it wasn't enough of a fight to even mention in his biography. But the biography section of the book. But the book is mostly on his filmmaking style and stuff like that in Samoa's life. But yeah, I do think Mizoguchi does translate better overall to America. So like she was known out here, and the last Mizoguchi movie she did, I think she did about 16 with him. It might be Ugetsu, which I think is 1953. I think Ugetsu was 53.
Woman in the Rumors is 54, and that appears to be the last one she did with Mizoguchi.
Okay, yeah, the one you just mentioned.
Sancho the Bailiff was also after Ugetsu, but it was basically Ugetsu, Sancho the Bailiff, The Woman in the Rumor, and then that was it.
Yeah, so, and, Tanaka, she wanted to direct films, and, Mizoguchi was not too happy about that, and nobody knows why exactly, and she never found out why, and far I can tell, biographers about Mizoguchi have no clue why he did this, but when she was trying to get approval to direct films from the Directors Guild in Japan, Mizoguchi stepped in and said, "No, she's a terrible choice. She can't direct. She won't know what she's doing." And that delayed her directing her first film, Love Letters. And when she found out Mizoguchi did that, she refused to work with him ever again, never forgave him, which, you know, was an appropriate response.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I just gotta drink water.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, which is kind of shitty, because Mizoguchi seemingly would be fine with a woman directing a film, given he gave women much better parts compared to everyone else at the time. Like, because Ozu was still ramping up to, like, top Ozu at this point in time in the early 50s. Kurosawa, you know, he did his one great female-led picture with Tsugihara, and kind of nothing else after that. I mean, there are some good female roles here and there, but outside of No Regrets for Our Youth, he just didn't really focus on women that much. And, like, Kinoshita, he was popular, but he wasn't a high-profile guy. So, like, Mizoguchi was kind of, you know, known for making movies centered on women not understanding what women go through. And he, you know, appeared in his actions, he didn't believe what he was kind of doing for a big chunk of his career. So artistically, at least. So I don't know. Like, what are your thoughts on that whole thing?
I mean, it seems to be a common theme going through the male directors who did focus on women, because, like you said, when it comes to Kurosawa, it's been commented a lot that he's just didn't seem to have much interest in showing the woman's perspective in a movie. Although his favorite film was The Most Beautiful, which is definitely woman-centric.
Yeah, well, movie. His most personal.
I thought it was his personal favorite of his.
He always said most personal, and I don't know what that means. Maybe because he met his wife and fell in love when making that movie.
I mean, yeah, that makes sense, except for the movie's not about that.
Yeah, I mean, it is about women, too, but it's also a propaganda movie, too, that he did not want to make.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Ozu had a complicated relationship when it came to women. You know, makes many, many films that center around the woman's house life and stuff like that. But he himself didn't seem to, I mean, he wasn't like a feminist or anything like that. Like, it didn't seem like that was maybe that wasn't a Japanese concept at the time. Maybe
it was.
I don't want to speak out of turn, so I don't even know how it goes. But
feminism was a thing in Japan, and Japanese feminists helped craft the constitution and guarantee certain rights like abortion and divorce.
Right, and that gave us pigs and battleships, I understand.
Yeah. And there's a woman in the cabinet for the prime minister, I think in like 50, in like the late 40s. So like, yeah, they were kind of, and, you know, making some steps in the right direction.
Yeah, I understand that. What I'm saying is that when it comes to filmmaking, I think that they knew that there was a certain magic when it came to women-centric movies that a couple of directors tapped into that were, like, if maybe they weren't super successful at the time, but they became, like, highly critically acclaimed or something like that. Like, I'm not saying that they were knowing the future was going to be like that or anything. It's just weird how many of the times we've discussed these directors, and it's like, but you know, he never got married, or he didn't really like that that lady that was the star of his movie, or in this case, it's like we you know, put her front and center in a bunch of movies and use her all the time, but like I don't know what that means in context of like how much she's going to get paid or anything like that. So maybe he was just like, she's kind of my muse in a certain aspect, but like she's also an actress. I don't think that she should be directing for some reason. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, Kiyoshida famously, according to, I have to go find her name, is the actress he worked with a lot. This isn't helping, but the actress he worked with a lot, she was in the gossip, in all the gossip papers in the early 50s, the big rumor was Kurosawa was cheating on his wife with this woman.
Hideko Takamane?
Yes, her. In her biography, or a memoir or whatever, memoir, yeah, because she wrote it herself, she said that Kiyoshida never liked women very much. Yet he made...
I mean, that's Ozu, Kiyoshida...
Yeah.
How did Gosho feel about stuff?
Gosho later on made movies about women, but he also had a complicated relationship with women because his wife left him in a shit ton of debt, and their daughter got in a horrific car accident around the same time, and she kind of left him in a horrible financial situation where he had to sell everything, basically, and he almost lost everything.
So, enough of this cheerful stuff. You want to talk, enough of this cheerful stuff. You want to talk about the life of Oharu?
Sure, but Aloha Haru. There's some background stuff on that. I remember Tony Stella on one of the Wrong Roll episodes. He brought it up. Mizoguchi was apparently jealous of Kurosawa. This is 1952, and because to him he is this young upstart that came out of nowhere that did not earn the respect he got in his mind. Because Mizoguchi had been around since the 1920s. I think his first movie was like 1924, 25. And then this young gun makes Rashomon, and suddenly everyone is fine over him, and he was not happy about that. And,
Maybe you should make a Rashomon.
Well, so Rashomon is set in the past and is a costume drama. So Mizoguchi was like, okay, I'll make my own costume drama to compete with Rashomon, because I can be like Kurosawa too, in a nutshell. And that's kind of where this came from. And it's based off of a book called...
The Life of an Amorous Woman.
Yes.
By Ihara Saikaku.
Yeah, and it's it was published in 1686, and
ooh,
yeah,
scandalous.
Yes, and to even like have a more to like copy, not copy Kurosawa, but try to outdo Kurosawa, he even had Toshiro show up in Life of Oharu.
I mean, it, like, if that was a move to try to egg on Kurosawa, he did it in a way where he kind of neutered freaking Mifune, because he's got that tiny, tiny role where, yeah, he's a pinnacle character in the sense that he is the reason why her life, like, spirals the way it does, but... I honestly did not recognize him because he doesn't have any of his signature facial, you know, any of that little fuzz that he usually has going on.
I don't know, like, it took until I heard him talk to realize, oh, that's Toshiro.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it would have been interesting if Toshiro did more with Mizoguchi, but I don't think, based off of this very small... a slice. They are a good pair together.
I'm not sure he was like, I just wanted you to get at Kurosawa's goat. Now get out of here. You'll never work in this town again.
But also, this was produced by Shintoho, who also produced a movie we covered called Jengoku. Wait, was it Jengoku? The hell one.
It was Jengoku, I want to say. I'm going to look real quick on my list.
Yeah, Shintoho, because of that horror movie they did, it was such a colossal failure, and it cost too much, and it sank the company. But Shintoho, at this point, was, you know, they were there. They were around. They were trying to make a name for themselves. Is formed by people who left Toho because of I think payment. I think it had to do with money. Why people protested and left, and this is why Susumu Fujita left Kurosawa for a long time, because he was like he and Toho did not align with some certain things, so he kind of left for Shintoho. That's why there's, I think it's like a 11-year gap between where his appearances in the Kurosawa film. Because he shows up again in Hidden Fortress as like the evil general who changes his mind.
Right.
But,
yeah, you're talking about our friend that was in
Tsugata.
Yes. Sensual Sagata. I am not finding this movie. I know we covered it. Wasn't Gina on the episode?
Yes, she was.
I am not finding it. This is ridiculous.
It is. No, Jigoku, not Jin.
Jigoku. Yes. Yeah, I don't have it on my list. I'm going to have to fix that. Hmm. Yeah, because I was like, okay, Gina episodes. I wasn't on House. I wasn't on Houseu. Okay. Oh, The Vineyard? Okay, that was a weird one, but I think we did it before The Vineyard, and it's just not there.
No, Stray Dog was also Shintoho. Okay, I didn't know that. Oh, and Stray Dog, Kurosawa was not happy with. It's one of the movies he's most disappointed that he made.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, I know. It's not, it's one of his worst.
Yeah, nobody likes that movie.
Yeah, it's in the Kurosawa book I have. I want to know. He doesn't explain why exactly he was so disappointed with it. Like, he thinks that it was too formulaic, but whatever. I don't see that.
Sure, if we want to get nitpicky about it, I guess it does follow a kind of a linear path of detective work type thing, but we didn't really talk about that at the when we did the episode on it, but no. Yeah, it's spectacular.
Yeah, it is. Well, whatever. He can have his opinions on his own movies,
I guess.
Yeah, so Life of Haru, it's, I think you can sum the plot pretty simply as a woman is, has an affair, a woman who's a courtesan? No.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to read I'll just read this Wikipedia plot summary, because it's pretty short. And it covers basically everything we'll want to talk about. So the story opens as Oharu is an old woman in a temple, flashing back through the events of her life. It begins with her love affair with a page, Katsunosuke, and for some reason indicates Toshiro Mifune as if it's a big role. He's in the movie for 2 minutes?
I'd say 5 at the most.
Oh, I think you're giving him some extra credit. I guess if you count his floating face on that Buddha head. The results of which, due to their class difference, is his execution and her family's banishment. Oharu attempts suicide but fails and is sold to be the mistress of Lord Matsudaira with the hope that she will bear him a son. She does, but then is sent home with minimal compensation to the dismay of her family. Or her father, who has worked up quite a debt in the meantime. He sends her to be a courtesan, but there too she fails and is again sent home. She goes to serve the family of a woman who must hide the fact that she's bald from her husband. The woman becomes jealous of Oharu and makes her chop off her hair, but attempts to but Oharu retaliate. Man, I'm messing this up. It's harder than I thought. But Oharu retaliates, revealing the woman's secret. She again must leave. This time, she marries a fan maker, who is killed shortly after, during a robbery. She attempts to become a nun, but Oharu is thrown out after being caught naked with a man, seeking reimbursement for an unauthorized gift. She is thrown out of the temple, becomes a prostitute, but fails even at that. In the end, she is recalled to the Lord's house, in order to keep secret her activities and to be exiled within the compound to keep her secrets locked away. While being scolded for the life she chose, she attempts to find her son and in the process ends up running away as she chooses the life of a wandering nun over the life of an exile. So that's a pretty fast thing. There's a bunch of details that I do think are important that are left out of that small plot discovery, but we can get into that.
Yeah. I did not mention the name of the first female Japanese director earlier. Her name was Tazuko Sakane, and she worked with Mizoguchi for basically his entire career. In various capacities, she directed one feature film in 1936 called New Clothing, or Hatsu Sugata, and it was a big box office failure, and she was never allowed to direct a feature film ever again, but she did direct some propaganda stuff during the war, some shorts, like one called Working Women, others called Brides on the Frontier, and another one called Gardening in Spring.
Brides on the Frontier.
Yeah.
Starring John Wayne. And isn't it about brides? Shh.
But, yeah, she also co-edited a whole bunch of Mizoguchi stuff. She edited my favorite Mizoguchi, Women of the Night, which has Kinuyo Tanaka in it, and Osaka Allergy, which was the, if I remember correctly, the first film of your father.
Hmm.
And I think the only Mizoguchi he appeared in.
By the way, it says that my father was in this movie, but hell if I remember. Oh, I'm getting a text message. Yeah, it says on on Wikipedia, it says he was as old man. Now, the only specific old man I remember in the movie is the when she's a prostitute, that old guy's like, come with me. But it didn't. That didn't look like Shimura to me.
This is news to me that Shimura was in it.
Yeah, I don't think, if he actually is in it, he doesn't have a very big role.
I mean, it's probably wrong, because with Throne of Blood, I didn't mention this on the episode, but I found several things that said Shimura played the other guy that Toshiro was paired up with in the forest, which is wrong if you know what Shimura looks like. Oh, and I don't remember seeing her in Life of Haru, but Noriko Sengoku was in this. She was the in Stray Dog as the woman who they catch first, who tells about her boyfriend, the one who wants to smoke. If you remember that,
yeah, the one that weirdly smokes that cigarette. Yeah,
yes, and she shows up in early Kurosawa stuff. Like Scandal and the STD one. She's a nurse in that who's like
the Quiet Duel.
Yeah, she's like a pregnant nurse in that too, and she's in Seven. But she had bit parts, but I always like her and stuff. She's when she has stuff to do, but yeah. So this Life of Haru sure is uplifting.
Let's see. The subtitle is Men Are the Freaking Worst and Nothing Has Changed.
Yeah.
That's the modern title. It's just gross how much bad things happen to her, and it is literally just all destined because of men and men's attitudes and men's control and men's standards and
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important to bring up Mizoguchi liking to show the suffering of women, because it's kind of I understand him wanting to depict how life was rough for women, but he never ever showed women ever succeeding in anything. From what I've seen, like, and in general, just women just having to suffer at, you know, the whim of just, and, you know, the men around them in a lot of his films.
Well, based on the, let's see, 5 movies that I've seen by Mizoguchi, Ugetsu, definitely suffering women. Oharu, obviously. 47 Ronin, we were talking about this before we were recording, doesn't really have very many women in the cast, and if they do, they're just kind of, you know, the wife or the daughter of so-and-so, or, yeah. Princess Yang Kui Fei, that is woman tragedy. And, it's all, that movie's kind of all around how the Emperor is having a hard time, but, yeah, the princess in that thing is just listen to the episode.
Yeah, I think and, that one we're both very tired, and it shows towards the end of that one.
Yeah, and Udomaro and His Five Women might be an exception, but only because it's kind of a farce.
Yeah, it's about It's about an artist, a male artist, and his, like, relationship with women in general. And, like, he has, like, five muses that he goes through that are distinctly different from each other. And, like, that... And also, I mean, also, I think Umaro kind of is different because Umaro was an actual artist. And he just took a portion of his life and just decided to make a movie around this one portion of his life. And, like, Force on Ronin was a story that already existed, / a propaganda film.
The only thing that's propaganda about 47 Ronin is the beginning part where it says, what does it say? Something about, remember the people serving your country across the sea or something like that?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Like, you know, support the military.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, she gets treated by like trash by, I think her father has to be the worst because, I mean, of all the people that have to, that are supposed to be looking out for you, this man is just 100% selfish. Like, it's, the whole thing happens because she has an affair with somebody of much lower class, and he's a samurai in the employ of some daimyo somewhere.
Yeah.
And so when it's discovered that this affair is happening, she, you know, the family is exiled as punishment. So I understand why he would be upset about it. So that's me saying this, but holy crap. Holy crap. Like, because there's only so many times you could tell somebody that, like, oh, I love you and I'm just looking out for you. And do terrible, terrible things like sell her into several different forms of sexual slavery.
Yeah, it's, I noticed that the main motif in this was, sex and money always lead to tragedy. Where, like, every time money is involved, that either,
sounds like a Coen's Brothers film.
Yeah, like, money with her... It's always, if money is, like, in her proximity to some capacity, it means things will go tragically wrong. Or, if she chooses or, you know, submits to sex, something will go tragically wrong. But, you know, like, like, with, like, for money, there's the, the guy after the fan maker, who was like a page or something for someone. I can't remember the exact relation, but he's like the kind of he's like the one kind of goofy character in the whole thing, and he's kind of mousy, and like he has the boss. Don't talk about.
You're talking about the guy that was like the delivery boy for the shop that was always staring at her, and at one point is like inappropriately putting his hands on her.
Yeah.
And then eventually they like, he like makes her run away with him.
Yeah, that guy. And like he bragged like, oh, I stole a whole bunch of money after I got fired. And she's like, that's terrible. I don't want to run away with you. And then, you know, cut.
He's like, what choice do you have?
Yep, and then, you know, it's been long enough that he feels comfortable, like, well, I took it as it's been long enough he feels comfortable, like, saying their names out loud, and, he, like, says, like, oh, Aharu, they want some of the sushi, and then, like, his former bosses are like, catch him, he's here.
Yeah, I was wondering what that was. Like, I thought he was saying that he stole the... Because he stole a lot. He stole 50 Ryo.
Yeah, like 50 gold coins.
Basically. Which is like, that's the big one. Based on my little knowledge that I've gotten from gleaming from the movies we've watched. So, and it's funny because like, even though they're in that village for a very short time, it seems almost like he's like stealing things anyways. Like, I'm going to feed her. Like, I'll steal this bowl of rice. Oh, she doesn't want that. What about, oh, can I have this? Take that from a table. And that's when he gets caught. It's like, so wait, this guy is really stupid.
like,
I guess it doesn't matter where he got the coins from.
Yeah, and he, like, he yells out her name, and it's kind of common knowledge that they ran away together, given that, like, that they're like, every time she gets fired from, she gets fired from, you know, a place, it would be very public.
And, like, it doesn't, in that particular scene, it doesn't even matter. Like, I don't think that the thieves or the bosses that were decided to kill this guy because he'd stolen from them even knew who she was. But as soon as, like, she was calling, you know, saying, like, oh, don't hurt him, to this guy who she's not friends with, but she at least knows and obviously doesn't want harm to come to him. They're just like, shut up, wench, you know, go back to the whorehouse or something. They're just disgusting people. Like, there's no other kind of man in this movie. Like, the only person who is the exception is maybe Toshiro Mifune's character, but even he, you know, after being told, like, no, I'm not interested in being in a relationship with you, is like, I'll throw myself at you until until you admit that you love me.
Yeah, like, in that scene, like, he keeps opening a different door to, you know, to look at her, and it's very melodramatic, and Toshiro overacting, which is what he was doing at this point in time,
right?
And like that scene is one. The whole movie's really well shot, but that whole sequence is really well shot and really it's generally interesting. And like the way they eventually hold each other, and she kind of like fine, and I don't even know how. Like, time passes in this very fluidly, I'm trying to say. Like, the way time works in this, you're never clear the exact amount of time. You just know, like, with every cut, it's like, it feels like maybe a few weeks to a few months in between everything.
And that's what it feels like, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, years and years have been passing, and it's, yeah, it's kind of difficult to glean what exactly how much is passing. Like, if you ask me the events with Mifune's character, when did that happen as opposed to when she gave birth to the Deimos baby, I have no idea. Probably a couple of, maybe like a year or two, though, because she was still pretty upset when they went to go get her for that job, quote unquote job.
Yeah, maybe.
But I'm not sure. But, yeah. I mean, by the time the movie begins with her already in her older age, you know, she's in her 50s.
Yeah.
So, as the movie progresses over the time, I guess we get to her living all the way through her early teen, or her, I suppose she's supposed to be a teenager.
Yeah, it starts in the beginning. But they say something like between 15 and 18.
Yeah. And then, you know, we get, you know, 30 to 40 years somehow.
Yeah, she kind of looks the same, but it doesn't.
Which really is match. Just like real life. Wait.
Which is crazy, given that she was, at this point in time, in her 30s, playing half her age. But it ultimately does not matter.
No, it doesn't.
But, well, on a positive note, we can get back to some more depressing stuff. The camera work is, as always, real impressive.
Do you have a specific moment in mind that you're thinking of?
There'd be a lot of shots of her, with, like, a new boss, quote-unquote boss, or, you know, man in her life, and usually from like a bird's eye view, which I feel like that implies like weird, it's reinforcing, like, this is a movie, we're spectators, and there's nothing we can do, like, what's going to happen, we are just going to observe. It's just kind of reinforcing the whole spectator thing of it. Slash, it's just, and it, I noticed a lot of that, and I did notice a lot of with exterior shots, it would be frozen, not frozen, but it would be still on like the on a very specific angle on a building, and then once the character who would initiate the scene would walk in a frame, it would lower and like follow them.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about, it'd be higher up and then just lower down, follow them like through the house, and just be. And there are a lot of very, very long shots in this.
Yeah, there definitely were. I found everyone's acting to be so interesting. I hate to say it. I just wasn't paying attention to the cinematography, set design. I think I got so distracted just by her constant, emotional ailment and the way everyone else was acting around her that I just let. I feel like it's a difficult movie.
Yeah, it is kind of a difficult movie.
I don't think I want to watch it again, for instance, because it's just sad. But I did enjoy the music, I gotta say. The score was good.
Yeah, the score at the very, very end, I really liked, because the music is very a certain way for most of it, and then suddenly at the last 10 minutes, the music is kind of erratic and weirdly beautiful. And it just kind of gets like the last score segment is very kind of abstract and weird compared to everything else, and this kind of adds to the weird sad tension of the whole movie, where it's like, oh well, is her life going to improve? Oh no, it's not. And I feel like it's kind of a weird payoff to have this kind of have the weird score towards the end. Not sure if you paid that much attention, but the score was mostly different in the end part.
I think that has to do, I mean, if it is that much of a difference, I do think that has to do with a change of her character, because at the end, she does actually, for the first time in her life, get to do something by her own choice. You know, even though she has to do it in a way where she tricks a bunch of people, rather than being once again forced to be in a position that she doesn't want, she decides to run away and become that wandering monk at the end. And I think the music was probably reflecting that finally.
Maybe.
Yes.
Yeah, and I know she was framed. She is framed compared to other people, either alone, alone or noticeably apart from a lot of people, or she was framed compared to men a lot, small, or to appear smaller, to appear like trapped, because they're like. The shot in the beginning where she gets into the carrier thing, which I always forget the name of. I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't know what those things are called either. I mean, it's not a rickshaw, but
it starts with a P, and I always forget. And she's kind of cramped in there, and I kind of took that as a visual for the a visual symbol. For like this, the lack of space women have in society, because like she looks particularly cramped in hers, where compared to the end where she sees her son, he looks very comfortable and he has like lots of room, or maybe that's because he's a child, but I feel like that was purposeful to show like her and the little carrier things looking kind of cramped and like they're just. And trapped in there, and shortly after that, like when Toshiro first comes upon her, she I think it's when Tears first shows up, she's like framed like just in the doorway, and she looks like almost like a caged animal in there. Not that she was aggressive or anything, just like she was just being kept there like a pet almost.
Well, it's improper for her to be, you know, wandering out or have freedom of, you know. she was in the beginning, not the beginning, but like in the, when we saw her in the earliest part of her life, she was set up for a completely different lifestyle. And like, I think that her expectations were to be kept in certain rooms and carried from place to place and seen a certain way only and stuff like that. And that's like, she does actually carry that attitude later, like in the scene where she is first being forced to be a courtesan, you know, that guest that shows up, she's like, I don't want any of your money because I think you're, what does she say basically about that guy? The person who turns out to be a counterfeiter.
I did not write down what she said about him.
Yeah, anyway, she won't deal with him because he's, like, way lower class, even, like, in her opinion at that point. Like, she's not, she still won't think of herself as being in this lesser position of like, somebody who's owned as a courtesan. You know? I forget what I was going for in talking about that.
Yeah, I feel like I'll sound stupid talking about this because this is more complex than I forgot how complex Mizoguchi can be at times.
And you picked the most complex movie.
Yes, I know, but it was this or Equinox Flower, which was Ozu. But we haven't done enough Mizoguchi.
Yeah, I don't know if I find him particularly interesting at this point.
It kind of depends on the movie for me with him in general.
Like, Ugetsu, well, that's funny, like, because I was just talking about how much I love the 47 Ronin. That feels like something different than the other couple ones that we've seen for him. Like, the other stuff is not made a huge impression on me. Even Ugetsu, for some reason, I have trouble recalling what was going on in that. And that's a big, you know, I was about to use President Trump's word, bigly. It's a very famous movie that a lot of people know about, but for some reason, in my mind, I'm just like, I think there's a ghost?
A sex ghost in that.
Oh, sex ghost.
Yeah, and well, Shindo.
Jeez, I should remember it.
Yeah, Shindo, who did Koroneko, I believe worked on Ugetsu.
Because
he did a lot of Mizoguchi stuff, and he rejected his style. Much like how Imamura worked under Ozu, and then when he made movies, he completely rejected his master style. Where, like, the Mizoguchi set design is very artificial and fake. At least to me, it looks very fake, and everything is very, like, prim and proper, where look at Koroneko, and it's, you know, made by the protege of Mizoguchi, and he's like, fuck that shit, I want to make my stuff, like, wild and, like, natural and primal, where, like, Mizoguchi...
Yeah, it all feels alive.
Yeah, where, like, Mizoguchi feels not stale, but it's very... Everything is very purposeful. Like, the way characters move in his movies, it feels almost, like, poetic and, like, ballet, because everything is just so planned out and proper about his style.
Yeah, it all fits inside a box of, like, what our set is specifically for this purpose, and the scene we're going to do is specifically going to be within this thing. Like, I'm thinking of even Princess Yang Kuaifei and even the 47 Ronin. There's something like stage, like I'm watching a theatrical production of one of these movies instead of seeing a movie when I think back on the way things are designed and character movement and things like that. Like, I think that the reason why I forgive 47 Ronin something like that is because there's so much story that he wants to show, and like even then it took like 4.5 hours for him to get that done. Oharu definitely gets excused. He fits so much into the 2 hours, almost 2.5, right?
Yeah, just under 2.5.
Yeah,
it's the length of a Marvel movie.
And there are, like, he does a great job of making so many memorable characters around Oharu in the movie that I think that it can be forgiven because he's getting these performances out of people. So it doesn't really matter what his set design idea and priorities were.
Yeah, like, I don't think it's a bad thing. Like, I love Seijun Suzuki. It took a while for me to warm up to him, but, like, Seijun Suzuki, everything is, at least for his Nikatsu, Joe Shishido era, everything is, like, very artificial and fake and, like, built just for the movie, where his later stuff is, it veers away from that. But, like, the artificiality you've done, if it serves a purpose and it's very clear, like with Mizoguchi stuff, it's, you know, I like the precise style and design.
Kind of. I mean, it's dream fantasy like is what it is for. You were talking about Suzuki.
Yeah, Suzuki.
Yeah. You know, because he's making his equivalent of gangster movies, but using that. The paintbrush, you know, flash across the screen kind of thing that he does, like the highlight colors, the pop art. But we're talking about the life of Oharu here.
Yes, life of Oharu. So,
so who do you think was the worst person? We already kind of talked about that, but
Besides her father,
there's
her father. That one moment where he pushes her into like the cart. And that moment felt it felt like she was not prepared for that.
Like her reaction. You mean the actress?
Yes, it looked like Tanaka was not prepared. It felt like Mizoguchi told him push her really hard, and only told him. Like it got the feeling, the way she reacted, kind of like in Fight Club where I think Brad Pitt punches the other guy in the ear, and Fincher was like told him to do that. And that was to get a genuine reaction out of him.
Yeah.
But the father was just, like, multiple times he basically called her a rotten whore. And it was just like, Jesus Christ. It just, like, it was just borderline unbearable at times, just being with him. And on one hand, I you were saying, like, that being in their situation, I understand his frustration, but it's just so rough and ugly, and it just keeps going on, and it keeps going back to him, where it's like after she gets kicked out of another place, it's like, well, we're gonna get another really ugly, uncomfortable scene coming up.
It's pretty interesting the wide range of different types of people that we've seen be samurai or ronin or samurai-like type people in these movies, because it's like I was thinking, like, as somebody who was a samurai, he should, you know, even being relieved of his position, I feel like he should have been a better person or something like that. And I'm thinking, like, no, Joel, you've seen a bunch of movies for this podcast where samurai are terrible people, and like they either, there are some super noble people, and that's like memorable, and that's great. But it seems like they run the full gamut. Like, for, you know, he could have been a person who been born into this position of power, and I think that's the case. Like, if you're going to be a samurai, you have to have been born into it that way. So, and then all of a sudden to be thrown out. Yeah, now he's like a whiny, what's a good example? Oh, like our president. He's just whining all the time about stuff like that. And like almost every other scene we see him, he's lying on the ground like,
He reminds me of the father in An Innocent Witch, the Go Show movie we covered. A daughter who has to go into prostitution because her father can't fish anymore or something.
And gets, well, he doesn't. He's never like, oh, you need to go do this for me, please. He's always like, oh, but I really want to get up right now.
Yeah, like their relationship is actually healthy, where this one is like the mother. There are a couple moments with the mother trying to be like, I understand your father can be bad, but at least I love you.
She's definitely what is the word? She's not fighting for her daughter in this case. She just goes along with this, but like, she's not only saying like, I love you, she's also saying like, but your father really loves you.
Yeah, it's,
and even at the end, like, oh, your father was so upset when you never returned home.
Yeah, which, I don't have children. I have a dog, but that doesn't exactly count.
Yes, but it does.
Yeah, but, like, the whole thing of, your parents are your parents, and you can't pick who they are. And it's kind of this, like their relationship is very challenging, but at the same time, like, that's literally all she had to fall back on. Seemingly, the rest of her family either died or abandoned them.
Yeah, I mean, she has to keep going back because they're always there, at least ready to take her in temporarily, and she doesn't have many other choices. The arrangement is made for her to become the mistress of the Daimo.
Yeah,
I do really like that entire scene leading up to that. You know, like the uh-huh. the poor old guy who can't walk because he's been rushed out to Edo uh-huh. to go find the right kind of woman and stuff like that. And I thought it was really cool that he brought out his big old glasses.
Oh yeah, I love those old school glasses.
Yeah, I think that's something people don't think about. It's like, that's not a European invention. Like in Japan, they were grinding lenses for that kind of thing way before us. And I mean, because this takes place in like the 1600s, right?
Yeah,
yeah. And, you know, when she finally, that guy's like, oh, she's the perfect one, and they send her off, and of course, at first, she doesn't want to, but eventually, she becomes part of the court.
Yeah, and the Daimo is Daisuke Kato from Yojimbo.
Which one was he in Yojimbo?
The ugly one with the weird teeth who was really stupid.
The unibrow guy.
Yes, he...
I love that guy.
Yeah. He's also in 47 Ronin in another serious role. It's kind of it's always jarring when I see him in Mizoguchi. It's like, oh, he's not going to be goofy and ridiculous here.
I mean, you never know.
Yeah, but Mizoguchi, at least his movies never really had a real sense of humor or levity, for that matter.
Well, life is very serious.
Well, yes, it was.
What was I? I don't even remember where I was going with that. Okay. Wouldn't she? No, actually, I don't know where I was going with that. So she ends up having the Daimo's kid and getting sent back, right?
Yeah, and but I love like this the trans, how you know time has passed, because it starts with like her spending some time with him, and he. And, like, she goes off to his room. I can't remember if she goes off to his room or, like, assistant says, oh, he would like to see you now. And then you get a cut and then...
We don't see her going off. It's just implied.
Yeah. And then you see her baby crying in the next scene. And it's like,
Oh. Well, that's the way it really is.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, okay, that's really, that's a very clever way to show time passing.
Mm-hmm. I like that scene because in the background there's a giant, I don't know if it's supposed to be a Buddha, but it looks like a giant baby
that
statue.
That's creepy. I didn't like that.
I was like, what? I've never seen that before.
And there's like a weird giant cart toy.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's full of baby stuff for babies.
Yeah. And
it doesn't matter. It's not going to be her baby anyways.
And there's like another woman in charge who used to be the head, like, courtesan, who I think is the head courtesan, but she's like, oh, I don't like this new blood coming in.
Well, I assumed it was his wife.
Maybe. I guess it was his wife. They don't. I never got a clear idea.
Yeah, because she wasn't dead. I mean, she just had become unable to bear children because of a sickness, they said.
Okay.
So I assumed it was his wife, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, like, I just love their whole thing. Like, you know immediately she can't stand Oharu, and they have, and, like, she summons her, and she asks, like, who are you? And then, like, just asks her a couple of questions and dismisses her, and then she is kind of just, like, is, like, steaming with, like, jealousy and anger.
Yeah.
At this, like, this young, you know, this new young woman who's a competition.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting at that point because I almost feel like the whole thing is played for a little bit of a comedic beat. You know, it's like, it's sad that she gets her baby taken away, but the speed in which they, like, just full-on get rid of her, like, oh, the Daimo's spending way too much time with her. Send her home. it's like, and then all of a sudden she's like, they kicked you out? Like, you could put that in a comedy movie. Yeah. It's not a funny situation. It's tragic.
it's very absurd as how it's handled, but yeah, like, I guess that's some comedy here, but yeah, that whole segment, like, they're watching a puppet play, which I forgot, I think I wrote it down, but it's like another type of theater that's popular in Japan with those puppets.
I have not seen it before.
I think Isle of Dogs is kind of inspired by those puppets, by that tradition of, like, those types of puppets, but does it stop motion, and, like, kind of modified it so it's doable for a movie.
Sure. So the one thing I wanted to talk about, the whole reason I brought that up is because they like establish a creepy uncle character who at first doesn't, I mean, doesn't seem like a creepy uncle. He's just a guy. And he's like, oh, in order to arrange the deal, he's like, I'm now her godfather. And then I think that's the same guy that she ends up working for later, like helping his wife, right?
Maybe.
I think it is.
And, like, the guy who's, like, when he learns about her past, he gets all weird.
Yeah, all of a sudden, like, he becomes all horn dog.
Yeah,
which
he
is
gets, like, all
super gross.
Yeah, and he, like, keeps asking her about it, and he's all giggly, and it's like, ugh.
I just wanted to reach through the screen and kill this guy, you know, like, break his neck with my fingers, you know, because obviously he'd be tiny if I reached through the screen.
Yeah.
Like, going like, oh, but you secretly liked it, didn't you? Like, I was forced to be a prostitute. Fuck you.
Yeah, that guy,
And of course, she doesn't say anything.
Yeah. But I don't think he had a wife. It was, like, his sister or something. Because, like, the woman says, like, oh, I think he likes you. Like, well, that's the guy she married or someone else?
No. Who are you talking about?
Because
the guy I'm talking about was the guy who had the wife with the bald spot.
Okay, no, I'm thinking of someone else.
Okay. Because she's the, you know, that's when he's like, oh, I found out she was a prostitute. And now his wife's like, oh my God, she's here to steal my man.
Yeah.
Jerry.
Yeah, and I think there's a story why she lost her hair, but.
She said, once again, it's attributed to a sickness, but I think, but in that case, the sickness was a one of the mind, I want to say. Like, yeah. I think she did it to herself. And based on how she ends up reacting later, you know, forcing Oharu to cut her own freaking hair, which, so much pain.
Yeah. Oh, we did not mention after Oharu has the baby, it's immediately taken away from her and she can't nurse it.
Yeah.
Which was probably the most heartbreaking scene, which was juxtaposed by that kind of weird comedic beat.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, this is screwed up. I'd take that baby away from her. By the way, go back to your parents.
Yeah.
And she just has terrible luck with those guys. Like, or not luck, like, those people are freaking terrible. Because, like, one of the very last interactions she has was basically the same, not the same people exactly, but the same type of people from that world. And they're like, you're lower. We're going to tell you exactly what you have to do, and you have to do it.
Yeah, but she gets revenge using a really cute cat.
A cat?
Yeah, has the cat, like, smell her hair.
Oh, yeah. Go in there and steal that hair. Listen, you can't train a cat to do stuff like that. I've tried for years.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever you say.
These cats will not steal people's toupees.
Have you seen John Saxon in a wild? Because that'd be the ultimate test.
That thing's sewn to his head.
Okay. No, he has to have... this is not the time for this John Saxon conversation.
We'll save it for our next movie project.
Yes. Let's see.
And anyways, I'm pretty sure that is the same creepy Godfather guy. And he's, you know, his wife gets all jealous. And then she... somewhere in between there, she ends up marrying that fan maker.
Yeah.
Okay, and she's temporarily happy. And it's so heartbreaking. Because when he just, like, leaves the house and gets killed... And then she tries to become a nun for Buddha. And once again, creepy uncle shows up. Maybe this guy is the true villain of the movie.
Yeah, because does he help set up one of them? One of the arrangements earlier?
Yeah, I think he's the one that the Daimo's servant goes to find a courtesan.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
That's what I was saying. Then all of a sudden he was named her godfather.
Yeah, and you know, and he, yeah, because like their dynamic by this point had completely changed, and he, you know, sees her just as a whore and nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, all it took was the information that she had been a courtesan for him to suddenly decide, like, because before it was like he was treating her as a daughter almost, and then from that point forward it was like, hey, hey.
Yeah, it's like she's not an innocent little girl, she's a sexual woman that I can take advantage of.
Yep. And I mean, that's just reality. That's reality now. It's not even...
It's always been reality.
It's men are... Like, we're both men. Yeah, and we both know men are disgusting.
Yep. I can confirm.
Anyway.
Yeah. And like, when you say she's... Like, people call her a whore, like, that's what people call her in a movie. I don't mean it in a disparaging way.
No, like, it's just said so often.
It's the language of the film. So, I know the preferred term is sex worker, but given the context of the movie, like, it's relevant to understand just how this woman is treated in the story. And Tanaka's performance is pretty outstanding because she manages to, you know, like, even in the worst scenario, she, you know, has, like, it's believable for her to bounce back. It's not like, I can't think of an example offhand, but like you buy that this character could exist in real life.
Yeah, and that she probably did exist. Anyway, what else do you want to talk about this movie?
So she runs into a small band of prostitutes who, kind of like in a Gay Flesh scenario, who kind of, well, they have an old man to go to, but they don't respect him, and he tries to assert his authority, and they always like
he's just a gross old man.
Yeah, but they just keep shooing him away, which I like. And like it's clear, like, oh no, with this here, the women are in charge, and like they. Like, she doesn't fit in with these women either, but it's kind of like a nice change of pace compared to the rest of the women in her life who are very passive or actively against her, where they're like, oh no, you can just join us, it's fine.
Like, yeah, it's almost like the first time she actually had friends.
Yeah, because like, even in the beginning, you never get a sense she had friends. She has since she was being trained for court life, and like this is the first time like she can be like a normal person almost.
Yeah,
and the setup kind of like reminds me of Gay of Flesh and Women of the Night, the another Mizoguchi movie, which these women generally care about each other, and I think, how does that go? That's where she gets picked up by this monk, who's like, yeah, you can come meet my friends, and it's like,
yeah, that's a great scene, because she thinks it's just a client who's picking her up.
And they're like, look at this woman. Would you belittle yourself and have sex with this woman?
Yeah, look at her face.
And it's just like, she's right there. Why are you doing this?
It's like, here's some money. See you later. You're a prostitute. You're not actually... I don't actually have to care about your feelings.
Yeah, it feels like a critique on religion.
It's just, once again, more men bullshit.
Yeah, and then she kind of has fun with it and, like, starts, like, acting like they call her a goblin cat, and she starts, like, hissing at them and clawing at them, and they laugh, and she laughs, and she manages to turn it around, and it's like, oh, no, she won this time. Like, I think, like, I take it as she pointed out how, like, she turned this ridiculous situation in her favor.
That's not how I took it. I took it at her as her, like, finally being like, I've been beaten down so far that, like, ha, I'm just gonna, you're right. I am a piece of shit. Ha, thanks for that money. Boo. Okay, bye. Because the next time we see her, she's miserable again, you know?
Yeah, and that's what she think. That's where she sees her son.
Well, that's when we catch up. The next time we see her after the monk part is when we catch up to her. The beginning of the movie, and she's in the temple, and she's just been reminiscing like Dewey Cox.
Yeah,
and she faints. And yeah, they take her to the doctor, and she's reunited with her elderly mother.
Yeah, and that's when and she tells her friends, like the other prostitutes, do you see the faces of your past loves and the Buddhas? And they start laughing like, oh yeah, they look ridiculous. And it's another kind of light moment.
Yeah. They don't have the difficulty like that. They're happy in some way that she isn't. And that's just another crushing blow. Like, what happens to her next, I think, is the worst kind of crushing blow, though, so.
Yeah, I think I mentioned earlier where she sees her son, like, the next big thing. And then she gets to live near her son. She can see him, but she can't be around him.
I mean, her mother presents it to her like, your son, his father has died, so your son is actually now the Daimo. And one of his first requests by messenger was that he wanted his mother to live with him on the grounds. And so it's like, oh my God, thank you so much. And I think that the scene is kind of purposely like sad, even though we've seen like this, like what's supposed to be a happy moment for her, because the two other people in the room both are looking down like, oh, this is too good to be true. Like, we know it's not going to work out for her that way. And it turns out, yeah, when she gets there, it's like, well, the whole reason we wanted you to come here is not because we want you to live on the grounds. It's because, well, if anyone found out you were the Daimo's mother, you know, they might find out you were also a courtesan and a prostitute, and we just can't have that. So you're basically imprisoned here. And by the way, you don't actually get to see your son. Okay, you get to see your son once, but after that, you're never allowed to see him or contact him. Like, I want to. Makes me so angry.
Yeah, and, you know, that turns into her running away and basically becoming a traveling nun seeking Buddhahood.
Yeah, like, and I said, that's finally her choice. And then there's a big musical number at the end, which is really weird.
Yeah, but, I don't know, it's like, Mizoguchi, I find to be complicated, not just like his stories, just kind of the politics of his art to be complicated. You know, it's just, looking at his art as a whole, just, I understand some criticism he gets now, but, I still think it is important, because he did give actresses good parts as opposed to his contemporaries.
Sure, he has that over Kurosawa, for sure.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he wanted to do, if this is what he wanted, or if the studios were telling him what to do, but I think he made everything work in a very artful way. Like I said, I do find his stuff to be very stiff, and obviously it's a bunch of them are super depressing. So not my favorite director, but I gotta say, Kanoyo Tanaka is, like, now that I've seen that we have seen her a bunch of times, mm-hmm. like, I'm just going to look forward to every time I see her in a movie.
Yeah, she rewatched Sendak number 8. That's kind of one of my favorite movies I've seen, I'd say the last few years, because I saw a couple of years ago, but it's kind of one of my favorite movies. And it's her performance in that just so, so wonderful. And it's a great.
Yeah, sorry.
That's another depressing movie, but I find it very watchable. Like, I have a strong stomach for like depressing movies. So like I would not watch this again. It's not. I know a lot of people see this as like not top tier Mizoguchi, but up there. But I'd rather watch like Unamaro again, or Women of the Night.
I'd rather watch Ugetsu again.
Yeah, I mean, Ugetsu. Sancho the Bailiff, probably not, because that's another real depressing one.
Speaking of depressing, I better watch that before Filmstruck completely disappears.
Oh, yeah. That one deals with the family being enslaved and the parents and kids getting separated, which I just realized is topical for now.
It's because the Dynamo had a quote-unquote strong immigration policy.
Their father was a politician and...
he was a bailiff.
No, Shancho is the guy who enslaves the kids.
And oh, good.
The mom gets shipped away because there'd be better slaves without the mother around.
Well, when you're right, you're right.
Yeah, it's, I watched that the same day I saw 12 Years a Slave, which...
Oh, man.
That was poor planning on my part.
So, yeah, only the happiest movies from now on.
Yeah, this is 1952. Do you have other 1952 movies?
Hey, we didn't discuss this beforehand.
That's true.
Probably. Hold on a second.
Oh, wait. Ikaru came out in 1952. We'll get to that later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I've actually got a pretty good one. That one of my personal favorites. It's probably one of your favorites.
High Noon?
No, not High Noon. It's a Vittorio De Sica film.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie I can never watch again.
No, but it is amazing.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's just... his best friend is his dog, and that just makes it so much more heartbreaking.
All right, you might as well tell people we're talking about Lassie.
Yes, Lassie. So, don't you send... would you recommend people seek out more Kinuyo Tanaka movies?
Well, obviously I would. Let's see. I just want to go through the list of things that I haven't seen yet that I'm looking forward. So, Ballad of Narayama, that's a Kinoshita movie.
Yeah, that's a really pretty movie that I personally didn't find that interesting, but visually it's really stunning. And it's Kinoshita in color, which is always interesting.
I love the cover. I don't know who made that one with the snow falling on what appears to be an older woman.
Yeah. Oh, Imamura remade this movie.
Imamura remade which movie?
Ballad of Narayama.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant The Life of Ohara.
I wouldn't be surprised if he tackles something like that. If he'd make it weird and funny and more interesting, I feel.
Why not? Equinox Flower. And always in for some more Ozu. Let's see. What is this one?
I think she's in Good Morning, possibly. I can't remember.
No, she... At least she's not... According to my list of movies that I've seen with her in it.
But she... She is in... She showed up in later Ozu stuff.
Yeah, Equinox Flower is from 58.
Yeah.
And she was, like you said, she was in those silent films. Like, we watched I Graduated, but I also watched I Flunked, But, which is I think it is just a shorter version of practically the same story. Yeah. She's also in that one.
Oh, she's in the first fully sound film, Japanese film, The Neighbor's Wife and Mine. Ooh. By Go Show, which is on Filmstruck. It's only an hour long.
She's if I've got an hour to spare.
She's in A Hen in the Wind, another Ozu.
Some really cool looking silent films.
Oh, she's in that Lost Ozu movie.
Dragnet Girl.
The Ozu movie from 1950 that kind of no one can find, apparently.
I found it.
The Lost One?
Yes.
Okay.
On VHS.
Really?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. Get out of here.
The Munekata Sisters. It's an Ozu movie I wanted to cover, but it's like impossible to track down.
Well, we'll just have to hop in a time machine and see it in the theater.
Yeah.
She's also in Sancho the Bailiff.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, definitely.
She's in Oriental Hairpin, which is a movie by Shimizu, how her ex-husband, she appeared in some of his stuff.
Actually, the beginning of her career, you were talking about how Ozu was roommates with Gosho, and
her ex-husband, or husband at the time,
and Shimuza.
Yeah,
yeah. So, like, her first, just going through the by directors, it's Ozu, Ozu, Gosho, Gosho, Ozu, Ozu, Shimuza, Gosho, Shimuza. And then in 1944, Army Kinoshita. And that's probably leaving some movies out, but she was in most of their movies in the beginning.
Yeah.
But she's worked with, she worked with, Kinoshita. She worked with Mizuguchi, obviously. She worked with Naruse. She worked with Inagaki.
I don't know Inagaki that well.
Let's see. I know the name, so
I just know the ones we covered.
Yeah,
and outside of that, I don't see many people talk about Inagaki.
He did Rickshaw Man and those two samurai movies that I've seen.
He did a trilogy of those samurai movies.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, Kurosawa didn't like him apparently.
Well, Toshiro apparently liked him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, she's in Redbeard, which we covered a while ago.
Yeah, although she shows up at the very end as the mother.
Not a very big role. But.
And Chichu Ryu, Ozu's favorite guy, shows up as his father in that same scene. I think
makes sense.
I think they have a line each at most.
Yeah, you fit him in. So, yeah, good stuff.
Yes, so, don't you send people into space or something like that?
Only if I have to. And then they never come back. So if you want to hear me be more funny than I was on this episode, you can listen to the other podcast I do, Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, with my fellow hosts, Sarah and Aaron, where we talk about science fiction and fantasy movies. What's in the docket for most recently? So, the most recent... Actually, I was trying to remember what the most recent movie we did actually cover was.
I forgot already.
Yeah, that's funny. That's a bad sign, right?
Did you skip this week?
No, we skipped last week. This, we didn't put a... I forgot to put a post up about this week's episode, but... The new episode was... on Wizards.
Oh yeah, that was a fun
Ralph Bakshi
episode.
Yeah. And that's a crazy movie that we don't actually talk about. I feel like we didn't really talk about too much of the details as opposed to the politics of what's going on in it.
Yeah.
But
you did
good conversation
in it.
And definitely.
You did correctly say I don't love Coonskin. I just champion that movie and think everyone should see it.
Right, it's your favorite movie.
No, it's just, it's a crazy experience that I think everyone should experience.
After Birth of a Nation. Yeah, weird taste of movies.
No, Bakshi had very good intentions with that movie. It just turned out the way most Bakshi things turn out.
Mm-hmm. So, the one that's in the can that I haven't finished editing, but will be up... by the time this podcast comes out, is we cover Dreamscape with what's that actor's name with the face?
Dennis Quaid.
Dennis Quaid. Thank you. Were you on the episode? Damn.
I know, because of the Snake Man in it.
Yeah, and Robert Patrick Kelly, I think his name is Patrick Kelly. Robert.
When are you gonna have
Max von Sydow?
When are you gonna have Andrew Schwartz on to talk about Flight? No, not Flight of Phoenix.
David Patrick Kelly. I don't know. I don't ever have time to arrange for people to talk to me on things.
Okay. When are you gonna have Martin Kessler on to talk about a Predator 2 or a Resident Evil movie?
Sure. Sounds good to me. I mean, I do love Resident Evil. The first movie.
He's seen all of them.
Yeah, They're great movies. I wish I could tell you what else was going to be coming up. We're going to be doing a movie called... you better edit out me hemming and hawing.
I will.
Super Fuzz. A movie called Super Fuzz, which is from the 70s, about a police officer who apparently has magical powers. We don't really know anything about it, but it was requested. So that's coming up pretty soon. And then earlier we talked about The Lost Boys with Gina Radcliffe from the Kill by Kill podcast. So
that's a fun episode. I was, for years, I only ever heard people my age say that movie sucked and it was stupid.
Mm.
And then hearing you guys say it's like, okay, I think maybe just it's an age thing.
I mean, I don't even know what to say about that because, like, it's...
Like, I was always told it's a so bad it's good or so bad it's shitty movie.
Mm.
But I think maybe it's because my friends, we tried to watch the Schumacher Batmans, which
yeah.
were unwatchable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I have... I think if I watch those movies, I'd watch them with a different set of eyes than I ever have now that I've grown to appreciate Lost Boys. Because, honestly, the first time I saw Lost Boys, I was like, oh, that was certainly an experience. I don't know if I'm ever going to watch it again. But I've kind of grown this affection about that movie just because of how over-the-top and cheesy and unlike any other movie... about vampires it is. So, I mean, walk into it, don't expect the greatest movie. You'll be fine. Like, it's supposed to be fun.
Mm.
And it's over the top. Like, it's a drag show, but it's vampire boys. Anyways, those are all available at the usual download places. Please don't send me into outer space.
All right, this will come out around the same time as our episode with John Cribbs on Kobayashi's what's it called? Black River, which has hashtag Knock Die Forever in it. And let's see. I just finished up on my blog Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema. I just finished up the series Hideo Gosha, The Line Between Sleaze and Prestige. Next up would have been Samurai and Sarsaparilla, looking at Japanese actors and Westerns. I picked out 3 Westerns for that, but because of a film strip closing, I decided to postpone that and cover things I have meant to review that I won't be able to review for who knows if ever at all. And one thing is a Go Show double feature of Burden of Life, a comedy he did in 35, and the first sound film with Tanaka in it, The Neighbor's Wife and Mine. So I'm going to do a double feature of that. They're both 1 hour long. So that's kind
of... What did the neighbor's wife and your wife do? I don't... What's going on?
Watch the movie.
It's just well, an hour... Whoa, I don't want to watch any of your homemade movies, man. That's gross.
It's on Filmstruck.
But Filmstruck is going away.
I know, that's why I'm covering that.
And I think we need to emphasize how upset we are about that, because personally, I am very, very upset that it's going away. Like, I feel like it was completely different than when this happened with Hulu, where Criterion was suddenly taking off of Hulu, because Filmstruck is unbelievable in its content. All the extra features, all the bonus things, and I'm not talking like trailers to go along with the movies, and not even just like intros like they do on TCM, like all the extra bonus feature stuff that comes along with Criterion discs is on there. All these movies that are not available anywhere else, like there, we've covered some movies that you cannot get on DVD, and thanks to Filmstruck, we were able to watch them.
Yeah, like Utamaro and Five Women.
Yeah.
Never had a official DVD or release outside of Japan at all.
And I don't want to make it sound like this is going to be the end of the world. I'm sure that there will be another way to watch that movie eventually, but it's a devastating loss for like film freaking lovers, as far as you know, for me, for everyone else that I'm friends with that covers this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I won't be able to watch Tuki Buki again for fuck knows who long, because that's only on a Criterion DVD that's out of print that you can buy for like $90.
Yeah, and how am I supposed to watch A Taxing Woman followed by An Even More Taxing Woman or whatever that sequel's called? Am I going to shell out the money for those DVDs? Am I going to shell out for anything other than Tampopo? I don't think so.
Well, the DVDs, you have to get imported.
I don't want to.
I know, but Tampopo's the only one that's been released in America, basically.
That's what I'm saying, but they're up on Filmstruck.
I know. Well, A Taxing Woman Returned is on YouTube.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But it's not as good as the first one.
Probably not. But, yeah, so I'm going to do some more Tommy movies, try to cover all the ones that... A couple of them, not all of them. And, what else was Japanese? I did finish the Gosha series. Oh, yeah, a lot of Gosha stuff is not available outside Japan either. So, if you want some Hideo Gosha movies that aren't the samurai black-white ones that are Criterion, you can just watch them on Filmstruck. And his masterpiece, the serial killer drama tract, which I think is, I just said, his masterpiece, and that's not available anywhere else besides Filmstruck.
Yep. Until November 29th, and then it's just going to be out of this world. Oh, there's Jigoku. We covered that way earlier than I thought. We covered it before we talked about Sanjuro.
Oh.
Jeez Louise, that was a long time ago, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and listeners, we have, at this point, a month and a half left, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, let's let you guys know. It's going to end pretty soon.
Is Wedding Ring, Kinoshita's movie, available in anything?
Nope, that's only Filmstruck.
No! God, like, I'm not even over the moon about that movie, but I think people should be able to see it. It's got Toshiro Mifune in his little shorty shorts.
Yeah, he's like in a Speedo.
God!
They have all 50 Kinoshita movies.
No.
And I think there are two box sets. There's like World War II Kinoshita. And
nope. You know, it might just be World War II.
Yeah, I think that's World War II Kinoshita box set. That like other 45 movies he made. Good luck trying to track them down.
Hunter in the Dark?
That's not... I don't think that's a release.
You need to watch at least Hunter in the Dark before Filmstruck's gone, audience.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Or Bandits versus Samurai Squadron, which I think it's equal. It's 30 minutes longer, but I think the 30 minutes are worth it. You get more Nakadai, and it's just as ridiculous and kind of convoluted, which was kind of Gosha's thing, was convoluted plots that make kind of no sense when you try to break it down, but in the moment you don't really care.
I know for a fact that Daisen no Kagemusha, the third Shadow Warrior, is not available for DVD rental or purchase. And that was a pretty damn good movie.
Yeah.
Sorry, talk about the rest of your stuff. I apologize.
No, that's it, pretty much. So I'm going to do the Go Show double feature. Been meaning to watch some Go Show stuff besides an Innocent Witch. And, oh yeah, the Go Show stuff I won't be able to watch again for I don't know how long. And, the Itami movies, a couple of those reviews will be coming up soon. And, I think that's it. So, thus the Samurai and Western stuff will be postponed a little bit because this horrible tragedy in the film community. And, I will be, this is November, I'll be on Rusev House Unite, the season 3 opener in January, I think, talking about Ivan's childhood, the Tarkovsky movie, his first film, the easiest one to watch. It's not Stalker, it's not a challenge to get through.
Solaris?
Ivan's childhood is really good. Although the end is really tragic.
Sure.
And that's it for that. See you next time for either Drunken Angel or the Black River. I'm not sure which.
One of those movies.
Yeah, one of them.
Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podient. Thank you for listening.